Paper 39, section 2, which is old single column, page 429. All right, so recall that last time we got started on the details here of the seraphim, and the details are a many. We've got, you know, these, remember how that list at the beginning of the paper gave you those seven different groups of seraphim. And then, as we discovered when we got into the first group, the supreme seraphim, there's seven subgroups. And it took us the whole time just to kind of get spun up and get going through that first group of the supreme seraphim. And now when we go into the second group of the superior seraphim, we're going to start to recognize the pattern that's going on with these subgroups. And so, you know, that's pretty much all we need to do. I mean, there's a number of things that we brought up last time that will kind of come up in context. So I think we'll just jump right in and let's see what they have for us here.
Two, superior seraphim. Superior seraphim receive their name not because they are in any sense qualitatively superior to other orders of angels, but because they are in charge of the higher activities of a local universe. Very many of the first two groups of this seraphic corps are attainment seraphim, angels who have served in all phases of training and have returned to a glorified assignment as directors of their kind in the spheres of their earlier activities. Being a young universe, Nebadon does not have many of this order. The superiors...
Before you go. Okay, so just, you know, kind of an interesting little tidbit that they brought in the beginning there, you know, with that qualifier that being a young universe, Nebadon does not have many of this order. You know, so it's giving you, you know, a little bit of a sense of the time scale that it takes for these seraphim to, you know, to have a what's deemed within their ranks as being a very significant amount of experience. I mean, you know, when we think of, you know, the oldest inhabited world in Nebadon is 200 billion years ago, we think, you know, my goodness gracious, you know, that's a long time ago. You know, and the seraphim would have been getting some early experience even before that. But, you know, the point is on the time scales that it takes for them to go beyond what they you know, have just innately by birth, like we were talking about last time. You know, you have a number of angels that, you know, are just created by the creative mother spirit into a different, you know, into a distinct type, you know, but then they can work on trying to go to other types, especially if they're one of the higher types. They work aggressively to try to penetrate all the way down and get the whole vertical spectrum. You know, but we didn't have much of a sense as we were talking about that, about, well, how long does it take? You know, so here, you know, they're pointing out that these first two subgroups do usually have a lot of attainment seraphim, in contrast to ones that, you know, superior seraphim that are just functioning in there directly as being born as superior seraphim. So, you know, that's giving you a little idea that we're talking about, you know, a lot of experience that goes into one of these angels, you know, spanning, you know, a great diversity of these different categories. Now, the other thing to bring up in that context, and we'll see it directly when we get in here, remember how as we were going through the Supreme Seraphim in those seven subcategories, we noted that we had the recorders in there, you know, like if you glance up to the previous section there, and item number 6, the recorders, and we noted that in the case of the recorders, you've got a very specialized group that are, you know, not so much are populated by, angels that are started at a high level and going down, or or whatnot. But it very much is a specialized group that are starting at the bottom and working their way up through the ranks and becoming more and more adept at these higher and higher levels of ability as a recorder. So the recorders are a little bit different, and we get into the groups tonight, we'll see another one that's like that. So they're much more of a upwelling phenomenon as opposed to just doing whatever in whatever order they're able to do it. All right. Let's see. Yeah.
The time thing.
Yeah.
So theoretically, in this, the superior seraphim therefore could take them as long as it takes us to become a finaliter to get to this thing in a way. And if the guardian seraphim who travel with us to the finaliter thing, so it's possible that a seraphim who's actually a guardian seraphim would become a finaliter or in the finaliter core before a superior seraphim might be a superior seraphim.
Yeah, okay. Right. So it's just, as a general principle, for those of you on the webinar, you're just wondering about, the variations on the theme. We read about one last week, Menosha, that has gone through a whole bunch of different categories and and is now serving as our associate chief of seraphim. So that's, it started as a supreme seraphim. So that's telling you that, okay, maybe a supreme seraphim can do a lot of different things in, in a much faster pace. Get all the way up, guide someone all the way up, get into the core of completion, say, and come back and whatnot. But perhaps lower order angels now have a lot longer time scale in order to get up, like they're pointing out, to populate these groups as an attainment. Okay? So, and we kind of saw that, last time too, they were mentioning that those lower orders a lot of times will stay at their initial level for a very, very, very long time before they move any. So, see, there must be a great spectrum of how place-like, or how direction-like the angel is, in terms of whether or not it can, get about this, in a short time, or takes a very, very long time. So, but just the very, like I said, despite all those variations, the very fact that they mention that is just so that we get a sense that it, it could be a very, very long time. It's not like they're, doing, a few thousand years at this one, a few thousand years at this one, and in short order, a couple million years, and they've, they've done everything. It's obviously can be much, much longer time scale than that. All right, so let's get into the first group here.
The superior seraphim function in the following seven groups. One, the intelligent core. These seraphim belong to the personal staff of Gabriel, the bright morning star. They range the local universe, gathering the information of the realms for his guidance in the councils of Nebadon. They are the intelligence core of the mighty host over which Gabriel presides as vicegerent of the Master Sun. These seraphim are not directly affiliated with either the system or the constellations, and their information pours in direct to Salvington upon a continuous, direct, and independent circuit.
Okay, so maybe just mention that last little bit first. Okay, so, every once in a while they throw in a little tidbit like this. So, the communication circuits, in the universe of universes is very complex. Isn't just one grid. They've got a number of different grids going on. And, so here you've got this very separate grid. You wonder, is it encrypted, so that no one can snoop in on this one or what? But this is an intelligence, circuit just to feed Gabriel information about what's going on. And in that regard, Gabriel C is the main individual in play here. So, flip back to the first group of the supreme seraphim. Those were the sun spirit ministers. Is there a pattern here? Is there some immediate relationship that you can see between the first of the supreme ones and the first of the superior ones. Okay, they mentioned right in that first paragraph that the Sun Spirit ministers are closely affiliated with the intelligence corps. So you have the bright morning star. Okay, so they literally point out how they're parallel. So just as you might suspect, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, to be in parallel with the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And so, okay, besides them literally telling us that they're, there's a parallel between item number one in each case, can you start to see some sort of a theme, that puts them in parallel? They are seraphim that are working with the suns, and that might be suns in administrative roles, so it might be kind of in an assisting in executive mode. But in the case of the Sun Spirit ministers, they might be working with the Avonals on a magisterial mission. But see, it's a sun. So it's they're tied to that sun ministry, whether it's a ministry that's coming down to mortals, or it's a Verondadex sun, administering a constellation, whatever it might be. But they're in that kind of a official mode of helping, kind of one of the main things that's going on to keep the whole universe of universes structured. So not surprising, they're group number one. Seeing these, they're kind of the ones that are at the top of the picture for that particular group of angels, like the supreme seraphim. All right, so we see that sure enough, there's that commonality. Sometimes it's really obvious. Other times you got to look a little bit to find something. But they've tried to give you something that you can find. There's no way, remember that we talked about this last time, there's no way they can give us a complete enough description of what these seraphim are up to for us to really appreciate in a very immediate way how parallel these angels are, because by and large they're doing things that we can't even comprehend. Okay, so you're looking for something subtle. They've tried to find something to help you to get this recognition that there's this parallel. And in this case, you go, well, Sun Spirit ministers, intelligence corps. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're not parallel. So they literally told you that they were. See, to help you with that one. It's very definite that they want us to really think about this. And you'll see as we go forward why I'm stressing this. If you really focus on thinking about this, you start to make some recognitions about what's going on with some of these issues they've been talking about here in passing. All right.
The intelligence core of the various local universes can and do intercommunicate, but only within a given super universe. There is a differential of energy which effectively segregates the business and transactions of the various super-governments. One super-universe can ordinarily communicate with another super-universe only through the provisions and facilities of the Paradise Clearinghouse.
Okay, and you'll see this a lot, where they use the opportunity to give you a tidbit that they might have given you somewhere else, but it fits in one of these blocks. So think about that. Why did they throw in that? They're giving you a little physics, basically, about what's going on with these communication circuits. Remember, we've been talking about them off and on for several papers. As we've been going through part one and into part two here. You've got these communication circuits that are set up by laying out two lines of energy, the two energies that are more substance-like and kind of can be the boundary conditions, the plates for a conductor. Okay, there's a line of physical energy that's laid out, and then in parallel to it, there's a line of spirit energy that's laid out. And then so you have a super additive consequence of some mind energy between those two lines of energy, and it's through that mind energy that the communication travels. Just like there's thoughts moving in your mind energy system, these thoughts move through those conduits of mind energy and communicate from point A to point B. It's like, okay, so So think about this. Why would there be this very definitive differential of energy, which effectively segregates, you know, the super universes from one another? Okay, well, one of the lines is physical energy. Is the physical energy the same in all seven super universes?
Yeah.
Yes. But the spirit energy, you know, it's a sevenfold individuation of spirit unity. The spirit energy in each super universe is just, you know, completely different, distinctly different. So there's no crossing that boundary. You have a completely different kind of mind energy conduit created with the seventh super universe's flavor of spirit energy compared to the kind of conduit that you get in the first super universe with the first universe's flavor of spirit energy. Right? So that's what's going on there.
Let me ask you about that.
Yep.
So if the first is the energy of the Father, let's say God, as opposed to the Son, and the seventh is God, the Father, you know, the Spirit, and the Eternal Son, isn't there some of the first in the seventh?
Okay. Now, so for those on the webinar, he's asking, it's like, okay, so he's trying to understand this difference of spirit energy. Is it, do you think about the pattern of the deity of the seven master spirits as you go around the seven super universes, you know, where you have father-like, and then you have son-like, and you have spirit-like, you know, et cetera, as you go around the seven. Okay, now that's the flavor of deity for that master spirit. What the difference of spirit energy is, I mean, does any of us know any mechanics of spirit substance? I don't think you can jump to the conclusion that there's father-flavored spirit energy. There's father-type deity, but spirit, you know, substance is a different fact. So, I really don't know how you would begin to think about this. It might be that in many ways we won't really understand what the difference is until we get to Avona. Remember, they kind of make that suggestion that in many ways, you know, until you are there, you just can't comprehend what that other, you know, what another type of spirit substance is. Okay, I don't know. I'm just speculating a little bit there, but it's an area where, you know, there's maybe some research that could be done. Maybe if you continue to reflect on the revelation, you could eventually get to the point where you could start to speculate on some of the, you know, the nature of spirit substances and stuff. I don't know. It's just a matter of deity is a higher order substance, you might say, you know. So it's transcendent of matter, mind, and spirit. You know, so, I mean, and it's a distinct separate fact. See, so that's why I'm really thinking, you, in the same way that you don't want to try to understand what spirit substance is by studying matter, you probably can't understand what spirit substance is studying deity. You know, it's
so
probably very distinct.
Each one being, you know, more that way is more, what do you say, more the deity flavor?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, how the deity flavor of the master spirit relates to his spirit flavor, I'm not sure. How you think about it. Yeah, the physics, you know, is the same in every one. They tell you that. If it wasn't, that would be pretty problematic because, you know, we can see the physics of in the outer space levels, okay, and it's the same physics as going on in this room, okay? So, And sure enough, the revelators say just what they must say for the book to be valid, you know, that the physics is the same everywhere, the material physics. All right. Let's see, anything else in that? No, I think that's it there. All right. So that's, you know, see, they just give you those two little tidbits. So let me just stress it again. Obviously, 99.99999% of what those seraphim are up to is not even remotely suggested in those two little paragraphs. And it's not even remotely suggested because we can't even, you know, imagine in our wildest imaginations what the heck they're doing. Okay, and they're going to bring that up here in just a little bit. So let's so maybe just to tee you up, you know, for the next one, you know, look back at what the previous number two was. It was court advisors. Okay, and now we have in this one
the voice of mercy.
Mm-hmm.
Mercy is the keynote of seraphic service and angelic ministry. It is therefore fitting that there should be a corps of angels who in a special manner portray mercy. These seraphim are the real mercy ministers of the local universes. They are the inspired leaders who foster the higher impulses and holier emotions of men and angels. The directors of these legions are now always completion seraphim, who are also graduate guardians of mortal destiny. That is, each angelic pair has guided at least one soul of animal origin during the life in the flesh and has subsequently traversed the circles of Seraphington and has been mustered into the Seraphic Corps of Completion.
Okay, see, so this is kind of related to what we were talking about earlier. You know, we won't notice them mentioning the Seraphic Corps of Completion as much as they did when we were talking about the Supreme Seraphim. But remember, they told you that the Completion Seraphim are working with all the different groups. So here, you know, here they do bring it up that the directors, you know, now that things have gotten spun up in the local universe enough, are these Completion Seraphim, and look what kind they are. See, it's one of those interesting ones where they've, you know, become guardians of destiny. You know, a particular pair, and have gone all the way, you know, to Havona with their ascending mortal. Okay, but what are they in? Are they in the mortal court of the finality? No, you know, are they even working with you know, the finaliters? No. So, and if you remember when they talk about that, there's all these kind of different paths that these angels can take when they get to Havona. They don't necessarily end up, you know, eternally, you know, with you. Some of them are like this, where they, you know, they all complete the program on Seraphington, all of the angels do, but just some of them, you know, go to into the Corps of Completion. Okay, so that's one of those sort of little minor points that they mention, and here you see them being applied. Ones that have served as a destiny guardian, but don't go into any relationship with the fine elders at all. All right, and then that brings up that issue. See, so, I mean, obviously, you know, you can get all that completed in the time span of the local universe. The local universe isn't that young, you know, and they kind of alluded to it's not that young when they said, you know, the directors of these legions are now. Okay, there was a time when it was that young that you couldn't even have this, and so we had some sort of temporary arrangement. But we're old enough now that you can have angels that have gone all the way and come back and whatnot. Yeah, did you have another thought there?
I was just curious. As I talked about there, who foster the higher impulses and holier emotions of men and angels. I mean. Uh-huh. My point of view being the men's side, I often wondered how an angel does that, how an angel fosters my higher impulses.
Yeah.
Any idea?
I was going to bring that up. If the people in the webinar couldn't hear that, he's wondering how do they foster these higher impulses and holier emotions. Okay, so the first thing to note in this regard is, you know, as you glance at all these different names that they give for all these different subgroups, notice this one's a little different. It's not the voices of mercy. It's the voice of mercy in this case. It's like, well, maybe it's just because it's voice. Well, no, we'll get to the voices in the garden. Okay? So they very purposely said voice. Okay? That's to help you to think about that very question that you're asking. Remember something that we often forget, that all of the spirit ministries function together as if they're one. You're not going to be able to experientially differentiate between the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Truth, the Thought Adjuster, or angelic input. It's a unity ministry. It's a spiritual ministry, so it's unity-like. It's not individuality-like. You know, you're not going to have this part and that part. You're going to experience it, especially at this very immature level, very much as a unity. So those angels are sort of plugging in to that spirit ministry that's above your mind and adding a flavor to it. Okay? And the Holy Spirit in itself, because of the mother nature that it's coming from, is working to downstep spiritual ministry down into your mind. I mean, spirit is above mind, so it's not automatically going to get into your mind. The two are absolutely separated. Something's got to bring spirit influence down into mind energy. The mother does that. And if you have a thought adjuster, this amplifies it, because it's basically like having a direct conduit. You know, part of the adjuster is literally up there in the spirit energy, and part of it is literally down in your mind. And so the adjuster, you know, works to bring that down into the mind more. Now, see, so that's basically the answer to your question. How do they minister to you? They add an additional ministry to this unified spirit ministry, and that gets brought down into your mind. Now, exactly what we're talking about, like I said, in the next block, they're going to mention, you know, we cannot comprehend this in any way, okay?
We or they?
We. Cannot comprehend. I mean, so you can't expect me to be able to give you a precise explanation of how this influence, I mean, because they tell you point blank, it's not comprehensible to you, the mechanics of what's going on here. But the basics we can understand, you know, what I just described. You know? So there, you have all these different spirit influences, and they all just, you know, add to this, you know, color, flavor, whatever you want to say, of the spirit substance that you are being influenced by.
Now, is it too simple to think of it as because we feel mercy and we're merciful that these angels are guiding us or inspiring us to feel mercy for other people and not be sent
right,
to the
right? I mean, obviously that's what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to augment your manifestation of mercy. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you know, mechanically, how do they do that? See, that's what we don't understand. But yeah, I mean, what they're saying there is straightforward. You know, they call them the voice of mercy because they are going to catalyze your ability to consciousize mercy and exercise mercy.
What about the people that don't exercise it?
Well, I mean, all these, none of these angels are going to do anything for us if we don't supply the favorable conditions. Right? All of this is dependent upon favorable conditions on your part. You know, so it's just wishful thinking to think that any of this stuff means anything, you know, if you don't have a cosmic consciousness mind. If you have a completely biased mind energy system, none of these things interface with it. Hmm. Okay? You know, and so it's just water flowing over the top of you, you know, in a sense.
And it's all augmented from the personality, because we have right. to use our personality, right. which is right. God's personality, basically, to enhance all these.
Your God-given personality.
Yeah.
I mean, distinguish that. Don't call it God's personality. It's from God, but it's not.
Well, the pattern.
Yeah. I mean, right. It's a personality, from God. Like you're saying, the only way to have this holistic nature that can interface with these ministries is if you're definitively using your personality to create a holistic nature. You can't just be spiritual. Because it doesn't take personality to be spiritual, it just takes the sixth adjutant. Okay? You need to be, if you're going to use the word spiritual, you need to be in the higher sense of the Holy Spirit. Not the partly Spirit, the Holy Spirit. Okay? Okay? You can't just have spiritual insight. You've got to have an equal measure of logical acumen. Okay? You have to have, and moral discrimination. If you don't have those in a symmetric system, these things that are above the mind don't have any way to interface. Okay? So it's all dependent on that. Now, okay, so just to stress again, see that unity, like, that's why they purposely said voice instead of voices, to stress, that all of these seraphim act as one voice, you might say, see, rather than many voices. There's many, many, you know, there's legions of individual angels, but when they function in this mode, they function as if they're one fact. One voice of mercy that permeates that spirit energy system that you're engaged to. You're circuited in, the way we usually describe it. Okay, now what gives you the sense that item number two here matches up with the previous item number two? The ones that I pointed out are the court advisors. Well, as you're reading down in the court advisors, you see things like, that their duty is to see that all charges against mortal creatures are stated in justice and adjudicated in mercy. Okay. That's just one time when they mention mercy there. What's the basic common thread here? Like we saw with the first ones, it was sort of the sun, guidance in the local universe that was being helped out. Here, you've got the whole bit with justice and mercy, not just merely adjudication, but that whole domain of applied law, applied love. That's what item number two here seems to be working in different ways. Okay? So that's the commonality. See, and they make sure the word like mercy, see, occurs in both of them, so you can match them up and start thinking about, what's exactly the commonality there.
So, Chris.
Yep.
When they adjudicate with mercy. Now, if you're a person, now you probably don't know the answer, but if you're the person that does not have any mercy, then you're going to be adjudicated or judged. Does that, with the mercy credits, does that have anything to do with it?
You have mercy not because of your works.
Oh, by grace?
You have mercy by grace. Okay? Notice how that's immediately right there in that age-old question of works righteousness. We have to really come to terms with that post-Pentecost. What Michael did at Pentecost means that you can be just about as hopeless and clueless and useless a mortal as possible, and you still get resurrected. You get an adjuster, you got an embryonic soul. I mean, the grace that occurred at Pentecost is mind-boggling if you really try to, think about it. The most horrendous person you can think of on the planet is very likely not iniquitous, has a soul by grace, and will get resurrected. Okay, post-Pentecost, mercy is, very overt now. It's just, now it isn't a ticket to paradise for free, but it's a ticket to the first mansion world basically for free. You got to really work on not getting to the first mansion world. Post-Pentecost, that's like an amazing effort to achieve not getting to the first mansion world now. You may not make it to Gerizim, okay, but pretty likely you're going to get to the first mansion world.
If you're coming from here, it's going to be such a mind blow, you're probably
going to
make it.
So, yeah. It's just, it's hard to live long enough here for no other reason, to reach iniquity. If you had 500 years to do it here, okay, You know, maybe maybe there wouldn't be as many to getting to the first manager world, but you know, in this short little life, especially if someone is really, you know, stuck on sin, I mean, they're probably going to die at a very early age in a blaze of, you know, gunfire or something, you know, and so, I mean, they're not going to have time to get to iniquity. They're just, you know, too short a life. Okay. But anyway, yeah, see, so, but, you know, remember that, you know, there's just as much justice as there is mercy. And justice is not that thing that our animal origin nature really kind of has a negative bias toward. You know, justice is something that's just as grand as mercy on the level we're talking about here. You know, so, but it's obviously more of a challenge for us to think about justice in the way that it is on high than it is to think about mercy. You know, we naturally, our spiritual consciousness can bridge that gap and get a, you know, a reasonable idea of what mercy is on high. But justice, it's a lot harder for us to overcome our animal consciousness and appreciate a justice that you will delight in as much as you delight in the concept of mercy. Yeah.
Yeah. What about in the Jesus Papers, it talks about you will be judged and given the mercy the same as you've given mercy to others, something to that effect. So if you're hard on people, like you're not giving them much mercy, that's how you're going to be judged.
Well, see, again, you know, remember, judgment is, you know, you don't want to think in Old Testament terms about judgment, you know, which Christians have been doing for 2,000 years. Okay, that's just a very false way to think about the word judgment. I mean, now, you mean you have, you know, a soul by grace. So, like I said, unless you've done an amazing feat and managed to evaporate that thing that God built, which takes, you know, a negative godlike level of action, not just some animal origin cluelessness level of action. You got to go all the way up to a supreme level and unravel that thing that God built. When they talk about judgment, you know, just think about it less in getting off this rock terms. You know, which is why humans have always thought about judgment. You know, I mean, the word judgment is bound up in the fear humans have of, you know, death.
That's, you
know, right? I mean, you know, primitive religionists crave promises of salvation, you know, and a personal God who hears their prayers, i.e. obeys their materialistic prayers. Okay? You know, I'm saying take surviving this life and everything, you know, that Old Testament sort of judgment or Egyptian-like judgment out of the picture. Just think in long terms as you're ascending, you know, and you know, think about these, you know, these court advisors, you know, when they're saying that they're the seraphic advisors and helpers attached to all orders of adjudication, from the conciliators up to the highest tribunals of the realm. It is not the purpose of such tribunals to determine punitive sentences, but rather to adjudicate honest differences of opinion and to decree the everlasting survival of ascending mortals. Okay, so in that higher sense, you know, what is looked at to figure out where you're coming from in a particular situation? They look at your motive. Not your mindful intention, but back behind that, your spiritual motive. You're judged by that motive.
The picture of the caveman.
Right, you know, picture of the caveman, things like that. But you know, think about the concept of mercy. I could have the spiritual motivation of mercy. But you wouldn't know it, because as it goes from that spirit domain into my mind, and my mind is pretty primitive and takes some pretty curious twists and turns, and so when it finally comes out into something that you can see, you'd go, well, I don't think that looks like mercy to me. You know, when you think about that quote that you brought up, you know, think about it in that context of, you know, are you striving to be altruistic? Let's kind of, you know, put it in collective terms, you know, as opposed to just saying mercy. You know, are you striving to be altruistic, even if you have a really kind of a twisted idea of what that should manifest, you know, through your hands and your mouth? Okay. Do you have a motive that's merciful? Yeah, there's a question on the, on there about that too.
Yes, Roger found 39:1-2 states that that divine justice is fairness based on the knowledge of the underlying facts of personal motives and racial tendencies. Mm-hmm. The question is there any mortal on the planet that has this complete knowledge?
Right. See, again, like I said, I mean, you're judged very gingerly in terms of this life, and that's why I brought up, you know, the, you know, you get up higher, okay, and you know, you're judged more definitively because there more of it is expected of you, but it is still the case, high or low, that if there is something genuine happening, it's an encirclement phenomenon. You know, Jesus tried to stress that all the time, that encirclement phenomenon. You mean if you're trying to understand forgiveness from God, it's like, well, you got to think about that as being in a circuit. You know, if it's not, if there's not forgiveness flowing from you to someone else, then, you know, you aren't benefiting from that, you know. So you want to always think of these things like mercy in a dynamic, encircuited way. Yeah, but,
because it holds you back, for instance, if you don't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, you're trying to become a dynamic phenomenon. See, and if you don't let yourself do that, you're holding yourself back. You're holding yourself back from being grown, being part of the dynamic cosmic system. Yeah. Is there a question back there?
Uh-huh. The difference between, like, you know, emotional and spiritual souls versus people like murderers or rapists or abusers, are we judged any differently or are we on the same, you know, basic plan?
Again, about judgment, rather than thinking about what you aren't being judged, technically, what's being assessed is what you are. Now, obviously, if you spend your whole life murdering people, you're not exactly going about doing good. But what's assessed is how much goodness is there. And the answer will be just a very itty little bit that was given by grace. But they're not saying, they're not looking at how much you aren't, they're looking at how much you are. And evil or sin is the absence of something, rather than the presence of something negative and literal that's being quote-unquote judged.
So even that little speck of goodness can move on to something else.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying, see, the amazing thing about post-Pentecost is that all of us are given an initial measure of goodness by grace. You have to actively get rid of that in order to not make it now. You might get to the first mansion world, but whether or not you're going to get many more mansion worlds, if you're really stuck on that idea of doing everything negative that you can think of. Right now you have a lot of material inertia, and it takes a long time to unravel yourself here. But you remember in the next life, you don't serve two masters; you serve only one, and that one master is very fluid, not so solid. And if you want to turn it into emptiness, you can do that very quickly there. You know, so those who are really bent on a negative, destiny. We'll get their wish in short order in the first mansion world, you know, because you can turn that Marantia system negative really quickly, you know. It's like, you know, flipping a liquid crystal display, okay? You can just flip it. But when it's a solid, it's a lot harder to turn around, and it's a lot harder for you to get up high enough to turn the thing that's important around. You know, it doesn't matter how screwed up your mortal self is, if your potentially immortal self is still undamaged, you know, it gets resurrected and is fine. I mean, you may not have gotten up high enough to do any damage to that, you know, perfectly constructed embryonic soul that you were given by grace. And see, so the boat anchor of matter, is, you can see it as it's a double-edged sword. It's positive and a negative. I mean, it holds you back from being more spiritual if you'd like to be more spiritual right now, but it also keeps you from being, twisted spiritual in your ignorance and messing up your soul. Yeah. So, yep.
Well, that was part of the Lucifer Manifesto. I mean, he said, well, basically everybody survives, so what the heck is this all about?
Yeah.
Was a pretty short term. So he said, well, if that's going to be the case, then I can break the rules. So on and so forth. But it's an interesting concept of what you're talking about, because one could take it to the other end and say, well, if I'm going to survive anyway, I'll have to do what I damn well please. Mm-hmm. That's not really I think in today's world we're not evolved yet to be able to handle that kind of freedom, so to speak. That's versus, I think it's a little bit better that people believe or feel that it's not the right way to go about things from one point of view until they get to a point where they've evolved to where they do it because they love doing it, or they're doing it from a different point of view, with a different understanding, if you know what I'm saying.
Right. I mean, sum that up, and then we'll keep going here. Remember that someone who's a biologic adult on this planet can do a lot of very unfortunate things, but it may be nothing more than arrested development, and they're just an extremely selfish little child still, And I mean, if it's just a selfishness on steroids. I mean, that has nothing to do with spiritual things and stuff, I mean, that's just a brat kid, okay? So, I mean, it's just not, you're not getting up anywhere high enough in your mind to be doing anything positive or negative to your soul. Your jester's just sitting there twiddling its thumbs, and the soul is just that little embryonic soul that it made the moment it plugged in, and that's what gets resurrected, yeah. And that whole, messed up, selfish, or whatever mortal self doesn't get resurrected. All mortal selves die, no matter how juvenile they are or how magnificent they are. Jesus had a very magnificent mortal self. It was not resurrected. Mortal selves all die, It's only that potentially immortal self that goes anywhere, But his immortal self was a perfect copy of that magnificent mortal self. But the mortal self itself dies. And that's why he was having to come to terms with, the mortal self still had to face death. Doesn't matter if he, knows in his high mind that there's a copy and everything. I mean, he still has to know that he's going to die and he's not going to get resurrected. That mortal self is going to die. It has to face that, right? And no mortal self is, delighted at that thought, okay? Not even Jesus's. Okay, all right, so now, so there's the one and the two. Yeah, maybe just, pause there for a second. Remember they mentioned, that those first two groups are normally highly populated by attainment seraphim. There's apparently a bit of an upwelling phenomenon to those two groups. There isn't always kind of this upward phenomenon through the ranks, apparently those two. So, you can look at the items number one and two in the subsequent groups here and think about maybe they, come up. Like if you flip to the administrator seraphim, there's justice guides in is group number two. See, so maybe they're working their way up, into law forecasters and then up into the voice of mercy, for instance. Okay. All right, let's get the next one here. Oh, or is there something else?
Another comment. When it comes to judgment, consider in one culture, if you to your neighbors and cut off his head and shrink it, you are made a chief. And in another culture, you yes. get the death penalty.
Yes.
The higher powers have their work cut out.
Right. See, now, I mean, okay, I'll comment on that briefly, because that's a good point. You know, remember the big problem we have in terms of our evolutionary past, in trying to think about the word judgment. It's tied to the word sin, and the word sin has always meant, what? Not deliberate disloyalty to deity. You know, it's meant transgression of taboo. Right? Okay. And so his point is very valid. And the mores have been all over the place, and hence the taboos have been all over the place, and even today, one group it's taboo to do this, and another group it's not taboo to do such, Right, and so, that has nothing to do with judgment. All the more issues and whatnot have nothing to do with judgment. So that's another challenge. If you're going to think about judgment, recognize that you don't have any thoughts about what is judged yet. I mean, everything that humans have ever talked about being judged is not part of the process, because it's all taboo stuff and whatnot.
Mm. Right? You do have a sense.
So,
from your thought adjuster of what's right and wrong.
Right, you do. But you see, it's all about you get this inkling from your moral discrimination that there's right and wrong, but you proceed to apply it to material things, not spirit issues. Right? You're judged on personal spiritual issues, not all of these materialistic issues that are taboo or whatnot. So that's the problem.
You feel better to do what you think is right.
Try to be doing good, but you could recognize now with the fifth epoch of Revelation, you probably don't even really know what that word means. Okay, but try anyway. You're judged by that motive in the spirit domain, not what gets down into your mind and what comes out on your hands and your mouth, directly. All right. So that the next group here.
Three spirit coordinators. The third group of superior seraphim are based on Salvington, but function in the local universe anywhere they can be of fruitful service. While their tasks are essentially spiritual and therefore beyond the real understanding of human minds, you will perhaps grasp something of their ministry to mortals if it is explained that these angels are entrusted with the task of preparing the ascendant sojourners on Salvington for their last transition in the local universe, from the highest Marantia level to the status of newborn spirit beings. As the mind planners on the mansion worlds help to survive, help the surviving creatures to adjust to and make effective use of the potentials of Marantia mind, so do these seraphim instruct the Marantia graduates on Salvington regarding the newly attained capacities of the mind of the spirit, and they serve the ascendant mortals in many other ways.
Okay, so before we get into the things that more directly relevant to us, let's just look at the pattern thing here. So the previous number three was universe orientators. And here you have spirit coordinators. Okay, so just the name seems to be giving you some parallel there. And what's happened here in going from the supreme seraphim to the superior seraphim, you had those superior seraphim, the universe, or the supreme seraphim, the universe orientators, trying to help you with what transcends the local universe. So if you think about it, so I drop down a notch, I've got three levels in the local universe. Unity, associativity, individuality as I go down, or you could say spirit, mind, matter, if you wanted to be kind of crude about it. Notice what these are, the spirit coordinators, or the unity coordinators. They're going to, they're focusing on that next notch down. So, it's one thing to encompass all the unity, the associativity, and the individuality, which the first group was doing. Here, the second group, we're getting inside the details, and we're doing the top level, the unity part. So you can just guess, when you get to this one in the next group, you're going to drop down to associativity, see? Okay, so that's the pattern. And and they're, you know, besides the specificity of what they're coordinating, orientating, whatever, you know, just they are, what would you kind of describe as sort of the overarching theme there? They're trying to help you with a particular facet of the big picture. You know, they're, you know, like when we get to the next ones, you know, they're trying to help you with the whole big picture of a social system. You know, here they're trying to help you with the whole big picture of spirit. You know, you're finally up to the point where you can start to get some sense more literally of what unity is. You know, so try to get the big picture sense of that unity instead of your, you know, initially very circumscribed sense. Okay, so so that's their role. Now the key thing in there, like I've been hinting at, while their tasks are essentially spiritual and therefore beyond the real understanding of human minds, okay, I mean, that's a statement that should give you some pause, okay? If you think you know what the word spiritual means, what did they just say? Right? It's beyond the real understanding of human minds. Right? Like you've heard me say many, many times, we have to swallow hard and come to the recognition that in general, everything that's been called spiritual by humans throughout all of history is mindal, not spiritual. Okay? At best, it's a unity-esque flavor of mind, okay? But we really have no direct sense of what that word is about. You know, and that's why it's so radical when it finally, you finally recognize as you're studying the Revelation, wait a minute, I think they're saying that spirit is a substance that you can build buildings out of. Oh, wow, that's different than what I've ever thought. That warm, fuzzy feeling that I had, you know, or those lyrics in that song about being spiritual. Oh, that wasn't spiritual, was it? Okay. a little point that John just threw in. Yeah, if it's this hard for us to even comprehend what spiritual is, what about religious, which is higher? Okay. Right. Yeah. So that should remind you of what a challenge is before you to try to be genuinely religious. You're going to have to just do your best to try to get out of the way, supply the favorable conditions, trust that you're going to be grown and that your personality will start to do things that are really kind of beyond your understanding, where you'll have a nature that is genuinely religious. Because what normally humans have called religious, see, tied to with what they've normally called spiritual, is not religion, but ideology. See, it's a thing of the mind. It's a religion of mind, right? Not a spirit. Right, so that's a very, very consequential statement, you know, for everyone to humbly appreciate. You know, and again, so if I have almost no ability to really understand what spirit is, oh, and personality spirit pattern, probably I'm not going to be manifesting much personality yet in this life, am I? Right. It's just there's so little that we can do in this, you know, initial life about the, you know, relative to these higher things. Most of it is kind of just super conscious and getting us going, you know, and that's why I'm saying, you know, just try your best to be as high-minded as possible, and don't try to figure out if you've actually achieved some degree of high-mindedness, because we don't really know the physics of it or anything, right? There's no way we can meter this. We're so ignorant of what we're talking about. But you need to be, you know, putting forward your best effort and trust that, if nothing else, that initial encirclement of grace that you have you know, has got you going in the right direction. And so if you just sort of humbly try to follow that inner sense of where you ought to be going, you know, you're probably okay. All right. It's one of the, you know, the really difficult things, you know, in very many ways to come to terms with, you know, with our ideas about soul, you know, I have soul, you know, or whatever, you know, our ideas of spiritual, I'm really spiritual, it's important to not really have that thought, you know, thinking that I'm really spiritual. I mean, because remember, that's what Lucifer thought, okay? You know, we're so ignorant, it's best to not presume about yourself like that, you know, and that's why they always say danger when they start talking about our attempts to be spiritual. I say, oh man, you got to be really careful of that. You guys are so ignorant. You know, you start getting into mysticism and whatnot, and you know, you could potentially stumble into something very problematic in your ignorance about what you're doing. You don't know anything about the physics, so you know, it's best to just not say that to myself, you know, to yourself, I am so spiritual. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump to self-righteousness from that thought, you know, with that initial thought, you know, and arrogance and pride. Remember, pride goeth before a fall. If not a fall, the fall, right? Right, I mean.
But it doesn't mean you can't recognize truth, love, spiritual things that you know are of spiritual substance.
To a degree, you know they exist. You know they exist. You should try to know truth. You should be trying to know goodness and trying to know beauty. But there's just some very humbling statements. You know, there's many religions that are very predicated on beauty. They call them grotesque. So, we think it's really beautiful, and they're going, oh, dear me. I mean, they literally use the word grotesque, you know. So again, it's so important for you to not think in terms of achievement, but, you know, in effort. It's not, you know, it's what you're trying to do.
When you reach the long, right? Stages of light and life as a planet, mm-hmm. there's got to be a little bit more reaching towards that spiritual.
Oh, well, I mean, on a normal world, by the time it gets to the Bestowal Sun, post-Bestowal Sun age, this stuff is quite definitive. You know, in everyone's mind. Remember, that's why they say, if they took you to a normal world post-Bestowal, it's so beyond your wildest imaginations of heaven, you know, and it's not even close to light and life yet, right? And it's beyond your imagination, because it's beyond your imagination, because see, it's genuinely spiritual, and spiritual is beyond our imagination right now. That's why a post-Bestowal Sun world is beyond our comprehension. Because he's come, a spiritual uplifter has actually come to that world in an effective mode. And the world is now spiritual, something we can't even imagine right now, right? We can't even imagine, you know, hardly what a post-magisterial sun world is, a world where philosophy has been uplifted. It all just requires a lot of humility about where we are here. Okay, now the next.
Before he goes on,
oh, okay.
I noticed they talk about the mind planners and the mansion worlds. You know, they said.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which we haven't read about yet, correct?
Yeah, correct.
That's later.
Yeah, that's later.
So they sort of are just bringing it up for now because we do read about it later.
Yeah,
sort
of like they do that. You know, remember, there's quite a few spots in here where they're referring up to the Marantia, you know, papers and. Yeah, foreshadowing them. But again, they're just pointing out, I mean, you know, spirit is a literal energy, Marantia is a literal energy, and you have these very literal things related to utilizing them properly, you know, and angels that are helping you with it. Okay.
Four, assistant teachers. The assistant teachers are the helpers and associates of their fellow seraphim, the teaching counselors. They are also individually connected with the extensive educational enterprises of the local universe. especially with the sevenfold scheme of training operative on the mansion worlds of the local systems. A marvelous core of this order of seraphim functions on Urantia for the purpose of fostering and furthering the cause of truth and righteousness.
Right. So again, it's this very mysterious thing of how they do that, but nonetheless, you know, so they're working on truth and righteousness, and it's like, okay. You know, and this one, C, is very obvious. You know, number four in this Supreme Seraphim was the teaching counselors, and so here we have the assistant teachers. You know, and you see they're working with the teaching counselors too. Okay, so teaching and teaching. So this group is obviously very definitively involved in a teaching mode. Okay, and so how does teaching, quote unquote, truth and righteousness differ from being a voice of mercy? You know, he's like, well, I don't know. The one thought you can bring in there is, if they say teacher, it's more directly related to the mind, whereas they're saying the voice of mercy, like I said, that's just an influence in the spirit energy system above your mind. Okay, so this would, saying teacher would imply that they're thinking a little bit more down, you know, down in the trenches about what they're up to. Okay. You notice it's just a tiny little snippet there because, you know, they are just working with the previous group and it's teaching and we don't understand it. Okay, so now you go to the next block. And you notice the number five is a huge block. You got a whole bunch of paragraphs here about number five. Okay, and here is where you got to notice something. You know, everyone, you know, who's read this paper knows that as you go forward, you know, number five is always the transporters in that group of angels. You know, but you look in the Supreme Seraphim, remember, we didn't have transporters. What did we have in block number five in the Supreme Seraphim? We had the directors of assignment, and that is not a sort of a separate innate body. Remember, it says a body of 144 Supreme Seraphim is elected from time to time. Okay, so really sort of innately, that is an empty block, you know, in the Supreme Seraphim that gets filled by election here. Because item number five is where the transporters are, you know, and there aren't any in the Supreme Seraphim. Okay, so before we get into the details of the transporters, just that little fact there should, you know, give you a hint that maybe there's something a little bit different about the transporters compared to all the other angels. Okay, and there are, you know, we all know the angels are always working in pairs. A transport seraphim, you remember reading about transport seraphim. Are you being transported by a pair? No. You're being transported by a single one. Okay. Now, this whole bit of breaking the angels up into supreme seraphim, superior seraphim, etc. Remember when they told you when they did that? They did that right after they get that initial education on salving, in our case, on Salvington, and then on the seraphic worlds around Salvington. Right, so, you know, they go through that whole initial process, and that sorts them out like this. Okay. And then what did it say back in the previous paper that was done immediately following that initial education, you know, and testing process? That's when the angels are regimented. Subsequent to that, they get put into, you know, the groups and companies and battalions and etc. Okay, so in other words, they're broken up into, here's all the supreme seraphim, here's all the superior seraphim, etc. And then they're regimented. So they're regimented, the supreme seraphim are then regimented and into those categories. And then the superior seraphim are regimented. They're not regimented together, they're regimented separately. Okay? So, you know, so there's battalions of supreme seraphim separate from the battalions of superior seraphim, etc. Okay? Now remember the way those categories worked. A group was 12 pairs. and 12 groups was a company, and 12 companies was a battalion. It was all 12s, you know, et cetera, as you went forward. Okay, well, if you're going to do that, you need 7 doesn't go into 12. But 6 does. Okay? So you go, oh, so maybe one of the 7 is not part of that regimenting. Yeah. The transporters. See, or in the case of the superior seraphim, there's not one, item number 5 is blank. See? You know, initially. See, so there's only 6, you know, groups to be regimented. See, so you've got, if you have 12 pairs, for instance, you've got 2 pairs of each of the 6. See, and then et cetera, it builds up from there. And see, the transporters are a distinct group. They aren't just your run-of-the-mill seraphim. Run-of-the-mill seraphim don't have heat shields and stuff. Okay? Those friction shields. And all the other attributes that transport seraphim. They're a special type. They can connect into the circuits without being in pairs and all this. Okay, and what is this special thing? We mentioned in passing way back when we did the Secrets of Seraphington. One of those secrets of Seraphington is the transport seraphim. Okay? What is the secret? What is the thing that's not, you're looking at the infinite spirit and all the beings, you know, and whatnot that come, that are, you know, part of the infinite spirit's family, and there's something you don't see, something that's secret. What fundamentally is secret? Well, remember, if you see the infinite spirit, you're seeing a pair. The Paradise Trinity and the infinite spirit are always in a pair. Okay? And what do they tell you about being able to go from world to world? Trinity origin beings can, you know, take themselves across space. So if you're seeing transport angels, they must have some relationship to the Trinity. That's the secret. That's what's hidden. You know, that recessive fact of the Paradise Trinity behind the infinite spirit. They have a definitive input from the Paradise Trinity through the infinite spirit, see, in that coupling, through the infinite spirit, they get a measure of relationship to the Paradise Trinity that allows them to be a being that can transport themselves. You know, when we're finaliters, we can transport ourselves. And who do we take an oath to? Paradise Trinity, right? See, that's just, you know, you have Trinity nature now, so you can transport yourself. Okay?
Are angels created in pairs, or are they created singly and they join up?
Now, they're created in pairs. Okay. Yeah.
So the pairs that are together.
Okay. Yeah, see, so that's, you know, that's a little kind of a mystery. I mean, I guess transporters are created in pairs, but they don't have to function in pairs, see, apparently. I guess you'd have to assume. But that may be a secret of Salvington, or Seraphington, I mean. Secret of Seraphington. Anyway, so notice that. That's the key, that they're not part of that immediate regimenting. No other seraphim can become a transport seraphim, and no transport seraphim can become some other seraphim. They're a separate order, okay? And these high-level transporters, I mean, you know, you're coming up the ranks. You start as a very low-level transporter, and you work your way up and stuff, okay? It's one of those very vertical ones, like the recorders, okay? The transporters are, you know, they're very specialized groups. And in the case of the transporters, it's very overt. You know, it's not sort of just their mind is kind of special, but they're literally, their body is different, you know, than a regular angel. Okay? All right, let's see. What else do we... Oh, yeah, there's one other thing. Okay, so now we've been noticing, you know, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, that we're seeing this parallel. Well, remember, if we've got a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, this is tied to the 7 circuits of Avona in some way. And remember, we said a lot of times we're probably not going to be able to recognize the pattern because there's a lot of Havona world. So there's a lot of things that, you know, are going to be specialized 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7s. But we're always wondering if maybe there's something general enough that we know about the difference of the circuits that we could see. Think about the secondary saprinifim. Remember those secondary saprinifim that help you on each circuit as you're going through Havona? Do you remember when you get to the fifth circuit, what do you remember what the secondary saprinifim on the fifth circuit are called? Trinity guides. Item number 5, tied to the Trinity. Yeah. See, so how, what's the, so number 1 is associated with the first circuit. See, the numbers are actually the same as the numbering of the Havona circuits. Assistant teachers, number 4 is tied to the fourth circuit, etc. Okay? All right, so that Trinity aspect. See, and remember, you're finding the third person when you're on the fifth circuit. Oh, there it is again. The infinite spirit, paradise, Trinity, you know, joined at the hip.
Pattern.
They're always there together. Okay? They're called Trinity guides, you know, but they're not, you know, they're actually, you know, getting you to discover the third person. See, there's a very intimate relationship there that's always coming up. So, see, you kind of know part of the secret. Yeah, you can deduce part of the secret. The Trinity is part of the secret. That's what allows them to do this. All right, let's read a little bit about them.
Okay, 5, the transporters. All groups of ministering spirits have their transport corps, angelic orders dedicated to the ministry of transporting those personalities who are unable of themselves to journey from one sphere to the other, to another. The fifth group of the Superior Seraphim are headquartered on Salvington and serve as space traversers to and from the headquarters of the local universe. Like other subdivisions of the Superior Seraphim, some were created as such, while others have risen from the lower or less endowed groups.
See, and you notice they actually said that right here, because these are very definitively one of those groups. But we noticed that occasionally there's others that, you know, have a little bit of a vertical, you know, thing going on like that. We started talking about this back in the previous paper. I want to try to help clear up some of these issues about transport seraphim that have been rattling around for decades. Okay, now remember when we were reading in the previous paper, we were in section 4 on the seraphic worlds, they were talking about that whole needing to pair up, you know, to do various things. And remember, they had that statement. It said, when they are not encircuited, they can work alone. Neither do they require complements of being when stationary. Remember that stationary word that we talked about? Okay, so now it's very important to think about that again precisely. Yeah, remember we talked about what they mean by stationary is not I have to freeze my hand and it can't move in order to be what they're talking about there. Stationary doesn't mean that sense, in that sense, because obviously that would be ridiculous. I mean, they couldn't blink, you know, without being paired up.
It means paper, okay? To write on, right?
It doesn't mean paper to write on. What does it mean? It means that they're localized. Seraphim have a lot of innate internal nature, which is not localized in space. Okay, and that's why you can have this 3 times the speed of light thing that we're about to read about. Okay, but in general, not just the transport seraphim, but the seraphim in general, if they're in the motion field, what we call a gravity field, of a world, if they're in that motion system, in order to move about within that motion system, they just delocalize, go with the flow, and relocalize. Okay? So they can move about without needing to be transported if they're on a world. Okay? But to go from one world to another, notice they're very carefully stressing that. We're talking about transport seraphim. Okay, going from one world to another, that's a different issue. You're going out of that motion system across space to getting to another motion system. So you can't just delocalize like a normal, seraphim can. They're going to have to be transported by some being that has a relationship to the Paradise Trinity. One of the functions of the Paradise Trinity is totality attitudes. A being that has a relationship to the total, and in that bigger context of just the total, can delocalize and then relocalize at another point in relationship to the Trinity rather than this more specialized method. Okay, this is how they're moving about. Now, see, obviously, we're not going to be able to do that anytime soon. Okay, and so we're always going to have to be, hopping on a cable car or something to get from point A to point B when we're on the architectural worlds. Remember, and they talk about that. They've got all kinds of very literal transport mechanisms, including fan doors and whatnot, Right? I mean, you have to have mechanical devices for transporting people that can't just delocalize themselves and relocalize, which just seems like magic to us. But that's what they're doing. Right? So, a spirit coordinator has to get in seraphim to go from one world to another. Okay. They're just, like any other non-self-transporting being. I mean, if they don't have that innate relationship to the Paradise Trinity, they can't transport themselves. They're not a innate transit being. Okay, so that's, that's, I mean, the real kind of missing key that, people haven't appreciated. And it's in noticing single words like that, and thinking about, well, wait a minute, I can't mean literally like frozen stationary. That doesn't make any sense. What does that word mean? Right? And like I was saying, if I'm moving my hand, we would say it's not stationary, but, focus on my hand. Okay, is my hands staying a hand? Are the molecules of my hand staying localized? Yes. My hand is a stationary fact. That's why, in the relativity sense, I could move with it, and then my hand isn't moving. Right? Right? It's stationary in front of me. If I've got a train moving, if I'm moving with the train, I look at the train, and the train is stationary. Right? See that? Okay, that if you can put yourself into relationship with it, and then it's literally stationary, that's the stationary they mean. Okay, it means it's localized in space. No matter, as I'm moving my hand, it's always at a particular location in space. It doesn't suddenly disappear from space and then reappear somewhere else, right? It's always at a location in space. It's stationary at that point in space for that split second. Okay. All right, let's read a little bit. Yep.
Seems like it's saying here, the fifth group of spirits are headquarters of themselves and sort of a space traverses to and from the headquarters.
Oh yeah.
Of local universe.
Yeah, okay.
Traverses all over the place.
Right, yeah, okay. So let's mention that. I forgot to, thank you. So there's a hierarchy of these transporters, and they're all, one is based at the local universe headquarters level, some are based at the constellation level, some are based at the local system level, as we go through these groups of angels. If you're going to go to or from Salvington, one of these transporters do it. If you're going to or from, the constellation, one of those do it. Now, of course, the from and the to thing, see, is, if there happens...
They're a different order of being.
Yeah,
they're... They do the same thing, but they're...
Yeah, they've worked their way up the ranks and they can handle a bigger job. Yeah. They can handle a longer journey.
So like taking our guardian seraphim from here to mansion world number one, where somebody has to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they're taking us to them.
Right. I mean, those low-level transporters, can handle going from a world to a local system headquarters. Okay. But these transporters will take you from Salvington to any point in the local universe. Whereas one on the constellation level can only take you to some point within the constellation. Okay, so there's that hierarchy, and then they're about to mention, the higher ones. Remember, you have primary seconafim who are transporters, and you have tertiary supernafim that are transporters for the really big jobs. Okay.
The energy range of seraphim is wholly adequate for local universe and even for super universe requirements. but they could never withstand the energy demands entailed by such a long journey as that from Yaversa to Havona. Such an exhaustive journey requires the special powers of a primary Sakonophon of transport endowments. Transporters take on energy for flight, while in transit and recuperate personal power. Transporters take on energy for flight while in transit and recuperate personal power at the end of the journey.
Yes. Two statements, yeah. And recuperate. Okay, so this whole bit about an energy range has nothing to do with what it takes to actually power the flight, if you will. Yeah. See, they get that, they pull that out of the energy grid line that they're riding on. Okay, there's, you know, constant in-flight refueling, you know, on all of these things. The issue is the angel herself. She has to go on one belly full for that whole length of time. Okay? And if they're a low angel, they can't go that long without getting their batteries recharged. Okay? Nothing to do with powering in the flight, but just, you know, their internal nature, you know, they will begin to lose internal integrity if they tried to go that long without getting juiced again. Okay, so that's the issue with that. And I'm pretty sure this is as close as they get to directly stating what, you know, I've been saying that you can really, you slowly start to deduce just by thinking. Look at how they describe those Sakonophim. See, primary Sakonophim of transport endowments. Okay, you know, that question of, well, can any primary Sakonophim transport me? No. I mean, the transport angel is a different type of angel. You know, the one that's your guardian angel can't transport you. Okay, any more than you can transport yourself. You know, remember, we're a lot like angels. Okay, but the asterisk is, you're not that like a transporter, you know, angel. They're a very, you know, and they're not that like the other angels. Okay, they're a very different fact, you know, a being that can actually transport itself. And not only that, has the equipment, you know, the machinery, you know, remember, they literally, you know, we're going to read about that, talking about adjusting these shields like they were, you know, shuttle bay doors or something, you know. Okay, I mean, you know, so it describes them like they were a device, you know, but they're a being, you know, so their body is very mechanical. You know, mechanical like in terms of what we can comprehend, right?
Yep. So then they talk about how they'd never be able to take the journey all the way to Havona. Mm-hmm. But they could travel throughout the super universe, you know? And you wonder about that journey to Havona. I do, anyway. Do they have to go over or under the dark gravity body, so it's
lost. the thing that is really taxing is, it is related to the dark gravity bodies. Remember, they talk about that. That is an extremely high energy environment that they have to withstand. It requires great exertion of nature. I mean, the lower being, you know, these lower transport beings, that couldn't withstand it. They'd be torn apart by it. You know, so it takes, that's why, you know, it takes those higher angels to do that, to cross from the super universe.
It's a long journey.
Right, they do. Yeah, you know, and they're, when we get, we probably won't get to it tonight, but when we get into the next block about the transporters, we'll start to understand what long means a little bit more, okay? there's some issues that aren't immediately apparent there, but the main issue is how taxing it is to be in that intimate relationship with those dark gravity bodies. All right, let's see, anything else there? Maybe just, you know, point out, notice how they describe it, never withstand the energy demands. See, just notice the way they say that, like there's something assailing you from the outside. See? Okay. Okay. All right, let's read some more.
Even on Salvington, ascending mortals do not possess personal transit forms. Ascenders must depend upon seraphic transport in advancing from world to world until after the last rest of sleep on the inner circle of Havona and the eternal awakening on paradise. Subsequently, you will not be dependent on angels for transport from universe to universe.
Okay, we already talked about that. It's because of you literally embody Trinity nature. Well, like we've discovered, we're not existentially Trinity origin beings, but we're effectively experientially Trinity origin beings. And all is said and done with our ascension career, we have a Trinity nature. We go out revealing God the Mother, you know, which stems from the Trinity, you know, and we can transport ourselves. And okay. See, so now here again, between the lines, it's not as direct as that previous one where they say primary saconophim of transport endowments, but think about this. Even on Salvington, they say, okay, you're not going to be able to transport yourself. Well, are you indeed eye level with seraphim when you're on Salvington? Yes, they tell you very directly, you are very much of like kind. Okay, so those seraphim can't transport themselves either. Okay, if you can't. Even as a first stage spirit, kind of going beyond, this domain of the seraphim, you can't transport yourself. See, so obviously, if you think about it logically, seraphim in general can't transport themselves.
But on Salvington, as you said a minute ago, they're on a specific sphere.
They can move about on the sphere.
Whereas we may not be able to, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe, at what level we might be able to have some ability to not need such contrivances to get about, I don't know. If you just reflect really closely and notice the little details, you can convince yourself definitively that, yeah, there's a definitive difference between transport angels and the others, and the general run-of-the-mill angel can't transport itself. So if it's going to take your soul from here to the first mansion world, it doesn't do it itself. It's got to, I'm pretty sure what it does is it sort of absorbs the soul within its, nature. Remember, not very many beings can carry a soul, so it's probably something to do with its nature. It sort of stores it within its energy system, and it gets in seraphim, and soul gets transported with the angel. Right, and it takes, 5 years to get there from here is our best guess, yeah. All right. So let's get some more here then.
The process of being in seraphim does not unlike the experience of death or sleep, except that there is an automatic time element in the transit slumber. You are consciously unconscious during seraphic rest, but the thought adjuster is wholly and fully conscious, in fact, exceptionally efficient, since you are unable to oppose, resist, or otherwise hinder creative and transforming work.
Everyone was laughing so much on that last one, you probably couldn't even hear it. let's deal with that, the funny part there at the end. All right, so, we all know that the adjusters are looking for one of these moments of favorable conditions to try to do something well. And so this gives them really favorable conditions where you are out of the way. You don't take their wonderfully constructed form and go, I think it's beautiful now. No, that's grotesque.
This could even be after you fuse, right?
Yeah. Fusion doesn't change the fact that you can't be you can't transport yourself.
The seraphim has to talk to you that way.
Oh yeah, the adjuster has to relate to you that way. Yeah. The obviously the mysterious thing is right in the middle there. You are consciously unconscious during seraphic rest. What does that mean? You sure you don't want to take a stab at it? Go ahead.
You're conscious, but you're unconscious, as opposed to being totally unconscious when you die.
Yeah, you're consciously unconscious, but what the heck does that mean? That's the key. Okay, let me explain. Right, obviously they're saying that confusing thing. So at the very least, you go, okay, so it's, when you're dead, you're unconscious. You're not consciously unconscious. You're just unconscious. Okay, even when you're sleeping, it's like, well, okay, you're not conscious in the normal way, but you're kind of subconscious, quote unquote, or something. Would you describe that as consciously unconscious? It's like, well, maybe. Okay, so then that's a clue. This is more definitively so, like what is going on with sleep. Okay, what they mean by this, the reason I'm conscious right now is because I remember my consciousness is in my mind, energy system. And when I say I'm conscious, between the lines, you mean that your consciousness is localized. Okay? When you say you're conscious, you are also saying, I'm conscious where I am right now. Mm-hmm. I'm conscious sitting in this chair right now. I'm conscious walking across the room right now. Okay? There's a localization. Okay, again, the mind energy is transcendent of the material energy. And this is one of the things we get into the details of understanding in Reawakening Philosophy 1, exactly how this works, what they're describing. Bringing that mind energy down into a localized relationship with the matter that it's seated upon. What they're talking about here is, you still have a mind that's conscious, but it's delocalized. After all, you're sinking, you're in seraphim within a being that's going to go from point A to point B by delocalizing. Okay, so literally, that's you're in a state where I'm not conscious when I'm dead because there's no mind. Okay, there's a mind. And it's just innately conscious. But it's not localized. It's not localized in the pod. It's not localized, at any point along the path from world, A to world B. You're delocalized. Okay? And so if your mind energy is not focalized down onto the matter, you have no consciousness of the motion that is that matter. So you have no... Your sense of time is tied to, as they explain in paper 12, is tied to your awareness of that motion. See, if you're not localized, you don't have that motion aspect, so you have no time consciousness. Okay?
doesn't mean you lose form, right?
No, you don't lose form. Okay. I say you don't lose mind. Right? You have form and everything. It's just that your mind energy is not localized in space and time. It's delocalized. Okay? And when they said there at the beginning, it's not unlike the experience of death or sleep, except that there is an automatic time element in the transit slumber. Okay, auto. What does the prefix auto mean? Self. All right. Okay? You have a self. Okay? So what do they mean by an automatic time? Innate within the self time. Okay? If you don't have this normal thing that we call a sense of time, that mind-perceived time, because of its focalization down to matter, if that's been delocalized, how could you have anything called time? Well, remember in paper 12 again, section 5, they tell you there's two higher levels of a quote-unquote time consciousness, of a consciousness of sequentiality. There is perfecting and harmonizing. Okay? After all, they just told you that the adjuster could be very effective in working on those two INGs while you're in this state, that perfecting and that harmonizing sequence, the temporality, if you will, of those INGs. You're moving along a sequence of perfecting, moving along a sequence at a higher level of harmonizing. Okay, but you're not you aren't relating to a sequence down at that lower level, that we normally just call time for short, that mind-perceived time, mind perceiving matter in its motion and applying its sequentiality and duration consciousness to it and giving you a time consciousness. That's not in play. But those higher perfecting and harmonizing are there. That's what they mean by that. So you got to put together all these details that they give you about, you know, up there in paper 12 and all this sort of stuff and be thinking about all these higher complexities. So there, see, you're consciously, you know, there's a consciousness that can be perfecting and harmonizing, but you're unconscious relative to, you know, being focalized down, okay, you know, into immediate in relationship to space and time. You know, so you have no idea how long, you know, in the normal sense of the word long, you are in that journey. You know, you could say, well, I was consciously unconscious for 5 units of perfectingness. Okay, but you're not going to be able to say how many temporal seconds related to matter, you know, and clocks, material clocks ticking on the wall. You're not going to know how many seconds have ticked. You won't have that kind of time consciousness. But, you know, think about this. It could be very interesting. You know, you can't get in the way, but you can feel yourself moving in a perfecting, in a harmonizing sense and going, ooh, I like this. Yeah. you get the clatter of the lower level time thing out of the way, and you'll be able to sense that higher sequentiality that's going on. Yeah. Can't we just stay in the tabernacle forever here? Yes. No, he's going to plop you out on the landing pad eventually. Got to come down off the mountaintop. Yeah. Face meet crystal. the crystal landing fields. all right. So, in order to really figure out what these kind of mysterious statements like stationary, consciously, unconsciously, so you have to get this recognition about delocalization. That's the key. Okay. And why is it that the thought adjuster is wholly and fully conscious? That's the mystery of mysteries. How an adjuster can be localized and not localized at the same time.
Is there right? More of an experience of unity during this time? That is what I'm wondering. I guess
not unity, harmony, wholeness.
Okay, because that's one thing. If you're not local, then you're,
right, you're part of the whole, yeah. See, and that's why perfecting and harmonizing can be so much more effective, because those are fundamentally holistic facts, less part-like things, you know, like you being spiritual, say.
Well, the essence of the adjuster kind of seems like that's the answer.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, just appreciate. You can't be conscious and, you can't be localized and not localized at the same time. You're either localized or you're not, just like the seraphim. Yeah, if it's localized, it doesn't need to be paired up. If it's delocalized, it's got to be paired up. Okay, but the adjuster—that's the mystery of mysteries. I mean, you know, if it lets go of you, it can move at effective infinite speed. It delocalizes and can relocalize anywhere in zero time. You know, there's no relationship to finite space. You know, it's innately totally delocalized, and yet somehow it's in your mind, localized. See, at the same time, quote unquote, right? Simultaneously, that's the mystery of mysteries. Okay, one of the ways you can very directly understand why it's mysterious, even to very high beings. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. That's illogical. How can you be localized and not localized? You know, it's like the beings. The so-called beings, super beings, on the Eternal Sun's worlds. They're illogical to everyone. They're going, well, that doesn't make any sense. How could, they're pure unity beings. That means they're not individuated. So how can they be a being? That is nonsensical, right? See, it's just things that we, you know, even very high finite beings can't figure out how to think about, right? But you can start to try to find ways to talk about it a little bit. You know, in some very high sense, there's an individuation, obviously, of those eternal sons beings. They're just, it's, their individuation is somehow completely transcendent of anything that even high finite beings can comprehend. You know, they know that they're totally not individuated from, in a, you know, even at a supreme level, right? So, you know, and no one understands absonite. I mean, you can take a really, really high, you know, divine counselor doesn't understand absonite. I mean, you have to have a transcendentaler to understand what that means. It's just a concept to a divine counselor, right? Doesn't have any direct experience of that. And the way something could be individuated, transcendent of the finite, okay? You know, and most likely those eternal sun, you know, related beings are, you know, probably co-absolute, and, you know, in nature or something like that, so. All right, so that's the deal. So you got these two working together here to make this happen. And let's read a little bit more here.
When in seraphim do you go to sleep for a specified time and you will awake at the designated moment? The length of a journey when in transit sleep is immaterial. You are not directly aware of the passing of time. It is as if you went to sleep on a transport vehicle in one city and after resting in peaceful slumber all night, awakened in another and distant metropolis. You journeyed while you slumbered, and so you take flight through space and seraphim while you rest, sleep. The transit sleep is induced by the liaison between the adjusters and the seraphic transporters.
Remember how there's always this very intimate relationship between adjusters and seraphim. See, so that's being utilized. And it's like, how does your consciousness get delocalized? The adjuster delocalizes it, you know, and it delocalizes it synchronized with the delocalization of the seraphim. Keeps you synchronized with the delocalized seraphim. Okay? So that, you know, you are with it, you know, you're, and yet not localized. So, you know, see, it's all very mysterious. Right, see, so that's obviously, see, you know, it's important to do that step first, and see, immediately that question is like, well, how does a Melchizedek do it then? Oh, okay, so that's telling me something about beings must, in general, have this ability to synchronize with the transport seraphim. Now we're never going to be without our adjuster going ascending, but maybe at some level, if we didn't have an adjuster, we could synchronize with it and delocalize with it. Well, they don't have an adjuster, but they have a fragment, of one form or another. Okay. Right. See, so that's an important, see, corollary that, you know, once you think about that, okay, so the adjuster is, as it can be in very intimate liaison with the seraphim, and the adjuster is in liaison with you, so the adjuster can get you in liaison with the seraphim. See, but you can't do it directly. You know, it's a lot like the contact personality, right? In order to get a divine counselor, you know, connected to a secondary midwayer, they can't do it directly, you know, but the divine counselor connect to the adjuster, and the adjuster can connect to the mind, and the secondary midwayer can connect to the mind, you know, and so you can get the two linked together. You're doing the same thing here. You can't delocalize and synchronize with the seraphim, but the adjuster can be the intermediary and do it for you, see? All right. And then there's kind of a pun in there. That second sentence, the length of a journey when in transit sleep is immaterial. Okay, no, literally, right? What were we just saying about the time? You don't have that focalization down onto the material level where you have the time sense associated with it. Yeah, see, so, yeah, it's a play on words. The relators never miss a chance to play on the words. Yeah, it's literally immaterial. You have delocalized from the material. you know, from individuality. Think about it in a more generalized sense.
But
yeah.
The link, not the title.
Okay, and then, right, and then so that whole issue of, you know, even though it's immaterial, it still has a length. And that's like I was saying. I mean, there's a length of perfecting this, for instance, that you could tick off. You know, there's a length of a harmonizing that you could tick off. You know, there is a length to it. Like I said, there's an automatic time element, like they're saying. There's a fully internalized self time element. But that self is not relationship to the external world. So there's not a time element of that association to the external world. It's totally internal. Okay, the length of the journey. All right, so I think, yeah, see, I think you're getting it here now. I mean, if you just pick it apart, and then it starts to make a lot more sense. Okay, now there's just the one little thing to throw in here. Think about how they said the relationship to sleep. Okay? You know, you can easily have a dream with a measure of delocalization in it. All right? Okay? I mean, it's internal. You're not literally like, you know, delocalizing and then relocalizing, you know, off in, you know, Moscow or something. Okay. But, you know, see that? You know, that's part of what sleep is allowing a measure of delocalization to give it a rest, to give the machinery a rest. It's a stress keeping it localized. Okay, and if you don't let off on that, you know, your fingers start to cramp up, okay? You know, the fingers of the machinery that is keeping your consciousness localized, it'll start to stress and strain and crack. So the mind has to delocalize to a degree. It doesn't totally delocalize, but the higher levels delocalize. And that's why dreams, you know, no longer are just stuck. You know, everything that happened in my dream happened, you know, with around my bed. No, you can just be anywhere in your dream, right? Right? See, that's because there's a measure of delocalization that mind has. Yep.
Well, I've done very little travel in my life, but I'm thinking some people love to travel, and that time of travel, it's like you're letting go of the ordinary cares of the world that you're normally burdened by.
Yeah.
Oh, you've done little travel. It's more stressful.
Yeah. Right, but your point, the person, you know, not traveling for work and whatnot, but, you know, but the sort of person that, you know, takes trips and what, you know, what motivates them? You're correct. You know, it's a desire to be less localized. Okay, and there will be less tendency for an individual to have that impulse, you know, if they're more sanguic of mind, they're more place-like. See, they won't feel as much stress being localized, you know, just staying in that little village their entire life, born, live, die, never even went over the hill to the next village. Right? That takes a lot of sanguic consciousness. But if you have any andite consciousness, you know, a little bit of direction, you're going to want to go to that village, you know, if not the horizon, and you're going to, need to, you know, experience more delocalization. So you're going to go on trips and, you know, whatnot. Yeah, you know, it won't be enough just to have that, you know, rest. You notice how they're using the word rest, you know, to give the system a rest by just in your dream life. You'll have to actually do it in your conscious life too. And, you know, go spend a month in Paris or whatever. Right. Yeah.
Margaret asks, so are they teaching you while asleep?
Yeah, so they're teaching you in this consciously unconscious state. See, I mean, obviously, if you were just purely unconscious, you can't be taught.
Yeah.
Right? Right? I mean, remember we said about teaching, that's more directly related to the mind. You know, that delocalized consciousness can be taught. And it's like, well, if you're taught, you know, you're going, you know, you're moving along a sequence, aren't you? Yeah, perfecting or harmonizing, like I was saying. See, you know, they're moving you along that sequence. Okay. Yep.
Any relation to a recording as you sleep? You're learning language while you're sleeping?
Well, see, now that, you know, just learning, you know, being exposed to environmental influences while you're sleeping, I mean, that's just reminding you, I mean, you are localized to a degree. You're localized enough that, you know, say the headphones are actually, you know, inputting something. If you were totally delocalized, you know, you wouldn't be there with the headphones to hear them, you know, or anything like that. So, yeah, you know, that, like I said, you're not totally consciously unconscious, you know, when you're sleeping, but the higher levels are, you know, are delocalized. you know, and it really makes you wonder, too, about, you know, if you delocalize the whole mind, you know, how does it still stay, you know, identified with the body? Like you were saying, you don't become formless, you know. I see. And again, you know, the suggestion is the adjuster is helping you stay, you know, stay there, even though you're really kind of delocalizing. You know, because it can be localized, it can be localized still, even though it's totally delocalized and can associate with your delocalized mind. See, so again, it's the mystery of mystery is helping, but it implies that other, that normal non-adjuster beings have, you know, some innate ability to do this. I mean, these beings must, you know, beings in general must be designed to be transported like this, so and so they can delocalize. All right, let's get some more here.
The angels cannot transport combustion bodies, flesh and blood, such as you now have, but they can transport all others from the lowest Marantia to the higher spirit forms. They do not function in the event of natural death. When you finish your earthly career, your body remains on this planet. Your thought adjuster proceeds to the bosom of the Father, and these angels are not directly concerned in your subsequent personality reassembly on the identification mansion world. There, your new body is a Marantia form, one that can in seraphim. You sow a mortal body in the grave, you reap a Marantia form on the mansion worlds.
Okay, so a little bit of tweaking there of Paul's, you know, famous passage in 1 Corinthians about, you know, the body, you know, that you're going to have in the next life. You know, he had a lot of recognition of, you know, of these things, you know, and that they've tweaked it. Instead of saying a natural body and a spiritual body, you know, they've made it a mortal body and a Marantia form. Okay, but yeah, that's what they're quoting there. They're quoting Paul and his awareness of adjusters and mansion worlds and whatnot to a degree. Okay, and then, I mean, I think for most of us, that's pretty straightforward. You know, they're just trying to get rid of the idea that somehow, you know, there's a bodily, material bodily resurrection. And, you know, in no way are we being transported. You know, like we said, our soul is part of a seraphim, you know, is keeping a very safe keeping within its energy system is being, you know, that seraphim is being transported, you know, so there's no really transporting of us, you know, unless you want to think about your brain, your Marantia brain being transported, you know, and that's, you know, and that's all there is to it. So they're just, you know, because they know an initial reader has all kinds of ideas about how you get to the clouds, right, and for harp playing. Yeah, so they're addressing that, all right. Okay, let's get the other group. So here we got the recorders, you know, part of that hierarchy of recorders.
Six, the recorders. These personalities are especially concerned with the reception, filing, and redispatch of the records of Salvington and its associated worlds. They also serve as special recorders for resident groups of superuniverse and higher personalities, and as clerks of the courts of Salvington and secretaries to the rulers thereof.
Why don't you keep reading?
Broadcasters, receivers and dispatchers are a specialized subdivision of the seraphic recorders, being concerned with the dispatch of records and with the dissemination of essential information. Their work is of a high order, being so multi-circuited that 144,000 messages can simultaneously traverse the same lines of energy. They adapt the higher ideographic techniques of the superaphic chief recorders, and with these common symbols, maintain reciprocal contact with both the intelligent coordinators of the tertiary Supernifum and the glorified intelligence coordinators of the seraphic core of completion.
Okay, so just...
doesn't seem like a lot of messages.
Well, remember, though, there's the huge content in one of those. You know, this is not dit-dit-da-da. This is not Morse code.
This is not like all the stuff we can carry, look at all the messages we can carry,
Yeah, but I mean, all of everything that's on the internet right now could be summed up in one symbol. Okay, and it's duh. Okay. to be crude about it. Now, you know, remember, you know, that the ideographic technique. Remember what kind of, you know, I mean, they can. You know, they can embody, you know, I mean, you know, the divine counselor gets the job, you know, and to be a revelator, and so he goes, okay, let me, you know, read everything that's been written and thought. Okay, got that. right, I mean, it, you know, if when they're saying 144,000 messages, okay, they mean, you know, one of those messages is beyond your imagination for information volume. Okay, so, yeah. I mean, obviously, because if you think it's like, well, yeah, we can put forward all, you know, a lot more messages. So they didn't even have like optical waveguide, you know, level of technology. No, you see, you got to ramp it up. I mean, you know, think about how your mind works. Okay, like we said, I looked at that picture right there. Do I start at the upper left corner and at 300 dpi rasterize it and go left to right, top to bottom, you know, and input it? No, I just bring that whole thing in all in one, you know, whatever you want to call it, one act. Right, I mean, they're using, the conductor for this is mind energy. And so it can hold, you know, just incredible amounts of content, you know, in a very circumscribed usage of that mind energy, the literalness of it as an energy.
That's the way I thought of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Got to think about it very non-linearly instead of linearly. 144,000 linear messages would, you know, that's ridiculously trivial. You know, we surpassed that a long time ago. See, so it's obviously not linear-like messages. It's very non-linear messages, and that's the ideographic thing, the picture paints a thousand words idea, and they're trying to get us to recognize. Okay. Okay, now, just quickly, the thing I was going to say, I mean, they're talking about how you got the completion seraphim are part of a whole intelligence core, but remember, if you want to study this more, you know, we've been reading about these recorder angels, high and low, you know, so they're just, right, there's this whole hierarchy from paradise all the way down to the worlds, you know, that they're part of. That's what they're alluding to. Okay.
Seraphic recorders of the superior order thus effect a close liaison with the intelligent core of their own order and with all subordinate recorders, while the broadcasts enable them to maintain constant communication with the higher recorders of the superuniverse, and through this channel, with the recorders of Havona and the custodians of knowledge on paradise, many of the superior order of recorders are seraphim ascended from similar duties in lower sections of the universe.
See, the two that they specifically say that, see, are the recorders and the transporters. And, you know, so that's, they're always part of that, you know, a vertical you know, experiential development process, moving up the ranks. Just the one thing to stress. Now, I mean, there's times in the book when they'll mention broadcasters, and you'll go, "Who are broadcasters?" You know, don't forget this. This is where, you know, they're explaining that the broadcasters are recorder angels. Right. So just, you know, try to remember that so you don't get confused at some point when you're reading about that. You know, so the recorder angels are not just the ones that keep, you know, the records. They're also the ones that are doing the whole, you know, broadcast receive thing, like they're saying. Yeah, they're the ones that are in charge of all that. All right, then the last little group here.
Seven, the reserves. Large reserves of all types of the superior seraphim are held on Salvington, instantly available for dispatch to the farthermost worlds of Nebadon, as they are requisitioned by the directors of assignment or upon the request of the universe administrators. The reserves of superior seraphim also furnish messenger aids upon requisition by the chief of the brilliant evening stars, who is entrusted with the custody and dispatch of all personal communications. A local universe is fully provided with adequate means of intercommunication, but there is always a residue of messages which require dispatch by personal messengers. The basic reserves for the entire local universe are held on the seraphic worlds of Salvington. This core includes all types of groups of angels.
Okay, so we're going to have reserves in every one. You notice that little kind of footnote paragraph at the end. There's a general basic reserve of all types of all groups up on Salvington. But there's specific reserves, all throughout the hierarchy, at the constellation level, local system level, etc. And notice one of the things of the reserves, this is besides just being in reserve, this whole bit about personal messages. And so you notice kind of the juxtaposition. You've got the ones that are the recorder angels that are directly involved in the communication circuit type of messaging, but the things that you can't do that way, that can only be communicated personally, the adjacent group here, coincidentally, is involved in that. So there's obviously some really kind of beautiful pattern to the way these groups all play together. That even something that sounds as other-like as the reserves, there's not going to be anything. They're going to be just so perfectly juxtaposed next to six, being number seven. Okay, and the reason fundamentally for that is it's not just a random 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This is the seven circuits of Avona. There's nothing about random about the relationship of the seventh circuit being close to the sixth circuit. That's a very fundamentally, incredibly transcendent juxtaposition. And so that, I just wanted you to notice that you can see that even in that little detail, even though they can't really explain anything that they're doing hardly to us. You can see that there's message, juxtaposed in six and seven here. Just try to notice those little details, because the revelators did their best to try to give you something to hold on to. So it wasn't just blah, 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 endless facts. Try to look for some patterns, so that you can you feel something about it. You feel some wholeness about what they're telling you. All right. Anything else we need to do before we wrap it up here? I don't think so. Why don't we just leave it at that here and take a moment.